Hello, it's Monday, June the 15th. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, the Iranian president Ahmadinejad confronts criticism of his disputed electoral victory.
People have been emboldened by the sense that right is on their side. They feel furious, they feel aggrieved, insulted that their vote, as they say it, has been stolen from them in this brazen way.
Media commentator Steve Hewlett discusses the digital review and what it could mean for the BBC.
In theory, there's an amount of money, let's call it 600 million quid, which the BBC doesn't need for its core purposes. The big issue here is what Carter says about that amount of money.
And America achieves another cultural first with a black female rabbi.
I won't be the spokesperson, or nor can I be, for all African Americans or for all Jews. I can only be the spokesperson for myself.
First, a news update and a paper review with Bill Overton.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has for the first time backed the idea of an independent state of Palestine. He says the Palestinians have to recognise Israel in their turn and not form an army. Then he'd be ready to start peace talks immediately. The US says it's an important step forward, but spokesmen for the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas have dismissed the offer. More protests against the re-election of President Ahmadinejad are expected in Iran today. During the night, the protesters took to the rooftops in the capital, Tehran, to escape police. In an evening rally, the president dismissed the unrest as passions after a soccer match. But all three of his opponents have now said the election result was questionable, and the liberal Mir Hossein Mousavi appealed to the country's supreme leader and the ruling Guardian Council, saying that fraud is evident. The first person outside the Americas to be killed by swine flu has died in Scotland. She's a 38-year-old mother from Paisley who gave birth prematurely. There are now 500 cases of the illness in Scotland, but the majority have mild symptoms. Meanwhile, the bacteriologist Professor Hugh Pennington has said there's no sign yet the flu virus was becoming more virulent, but it was inevitable that some people would die. The British Medical Association's warning that if there is a major swine flu outbreak across Britain, some GPs may refuse to work. It's because of an insurance wrangle, which means local doctors are worried about being sued if the outbreak becomes widespread. Doctors and hospitals are covered by NHS insurance, while local GPs have to arrange their own cover. Two winners, tennis player Andy Murray and the president of Iran, compete for the lead story in the morning papers. Beatings and arrests, but Iran's president hails a new era of hope, writes The Guardian. Ahmadinejad defiant is the headline in the Financial Times, below a smiling picture of him celebrating. The Times says Iran reform hopes crushed over its picture of demonstrators being beaten by security officers. And The Independent gives its front page to a full picture of a woman's eyes peering out of her hijab, calling it a face in the crowd, a cry from the heart. The words below from a student say she can only express sorrow for her country. As for Andy Murray, The Telegraph calls him the King of Queens after he became the first Briton to win the Queen's Club Championship since the 30s. It carries a picture of him holding the huge winner's vase with a rare smile on his face and writes his triumph whips up Wimbledon fever. The Mail quotes him as saying he can win Wimbledon this year, even though Queen's was his first grass court victory. The Express says, now for the big one, and The Sun simply calls it Wimbledon. There's more sport and news throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
We start today with the ongoing political upheaval in Iran. If the West was hoping for a simple end to this election, they're going to be disappointed with claims of vote fixing and riots in the country's capital, Tehran. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's team claims he won with more than 60% of the vote and has questioned opposition and foreign media's doubts over the legitimacy of the result. Yesterday, he held a rally to claim his position, but sporadic and unplanned protests are still flaring up, with 100 reformists having been arrested, accused of orchestrating violence. The Guardian's Middle East editor, Ian Black, is in Tehran.
We've seen almost unprecedented protests on the streets since Friday night. People have been emboldened by the sense that right is on their side. They feel furious, they feel aggrieved, insulted that their vote, as they say it, has been stolen from them in this brazen way. On the other hand, it seems to me that this is an unequal struggle. You're seeing the full force of the Iranian state deployed against the protesters, special forces, riot policemen out on the streets, chasing down demonstrators. It feels as if the government is much better organized than the opposition. It would be my summary of it. The opposition leaders have been arrested, their communications have been disrupted. what protests there are seem to be largely spontaneous and not very well organized. Mousavi himself is either under house arrest or not able easily to move, though he has called for a big rally in protest tomorrow, also in central Tehran. But I think we're seeing a display of a show of force by the Iranian state, certainly political statements, which make it perfectly clear that they won't brook opposition. Most people think, and you know, most people could be wrong, that the protests will carry on for another day or two or three and peter out, because they will meet the immovable object of that, the Islamic Republic and its political leadership, which is set on confirming Ahmadinejad in the presidency and seeing off the opposition, and just maintaining the claim that, as Ahmadinejad has just done at a press conference, that the election was fair, and that anybody who protests, the metaphor he likes to use is football fans who come out of a match and fall foul of the police, or people who get into trouble for traffic offences and are punished for that. He's not dignifying it with any sense of legitimate political opposition in the face of what he presents and the Iranian regime as a whole is presenting as a triumph of democracy, on a record turnout, on a turnout of 85%, which is extraordinary according to the official figure. And that figure is being used to underline the legitimacy of the result.
Can we call these protests a clash of the generations, the older generations, the more traditional or spiritual faction taking on the younger reformist voice, do you think?
Well, there's some of that. A lot of people in the Mousavi camp are young people, but there's plenty of young people rooting for Ahmadinejad as well, who they admire him. They think he's a simple, honest man, virtues are laudable, who stands up to the world. It's not just age. Not just age. There are people who, there are older people, of course, who despair of the way that this country is being run under him, and were desperate for a change. And again, they feel that in the way this election has come out, the prospect of that change has been stolen from them. So it's more than a generational thing. There are elements of that to do with social values and freedoms, particularly for women and for young women, I think, in particular. It's to do with a sense that under Ahmadinejad, Iran has become a sort of dirty word in the world. I think Mousavi said that under Ahmadinejad's rule, the value of an Iranian passport was akin to the value of a Somali passport.
Ian Black in Tehran. Now to our diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia, on the legitimacy of the election result. He tells us there are clues the election was fixed.
It's very difficult to say with certainty whether there is an election fraud. It's very difficult to find smoking guns. However, there are a lot of very compelling circumstantial evidence here. The authorities behaved in a very unusual way. It's supposed to take 3 days for election results to be fully verified and then declared. The declaration in this case was made only 2 hours after the polls had closed. The Mousavi camp saying they got a call earlier than that from the Interior Ministry saying that they had won. If you look around the country, you would expect peaks and troughs in the support for different candidates around the country, according to regional preferences, city versus rural. But the president, Ahmadinejad, seems to have got overwhelming majority support pretty much everywhere, including the hometown of his principal opponent, Mousavi, where, according to the results, he had 57% of the results. This is an Azeri stronghold, ethnic Azeri. Mousavi is an ethnic Azeri who had been polling very well, performing very well in Tabriz, and yet, according to the official results, Ahmadinejad scored almost as big a victory there as he did anywhere else in the country. So there's reason to have serious doubts about the nature of these results.
As I understand it, Iran's Guardian Council has 10 days, in fact, to confirm the validity of the vote. Is there any chance of the election going to a second round?
Well, not as things look at present, because the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, has stepped in very quickly to congratulate Ahmadinejad, seemingly cutting off any either formal appeal process or any debate within the ruling circles in the regime. So that makes it very difficult for Mousavi to pursue some kind of formal challenge to this result.
The global reaction has been pretty muted, hasn't it? A lot of foreign leaders sitting on the fence at this point.
Yes, it has been. It's unclear whether that will change when more and if more details emerge out of the nature of how the votes were or were not counted. It may be that the capitals in the West are waiting to hear from their embassies for a considered report on how things went, and they don't want to jump in too quickly. But they also were quite aware that they will have to deal with this regime. They always knew that there wouldn't be serious changes in foreign policy, and so they were already prepared to have to talk to a regime that was overall fairly hardline and conservative. And so they're really looking to the future and looking to the fact that unless they find some kind of diplomatic resolution to the impasse over Iran's nuclear program, then the region will be a very dangerous situation for the whole region. So they are looking to the long term, knowing that ultimately they have to deal with the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei.
The Guardian's Julian Borgia. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, the Falkland Islands accuse Argentina of a campaign of economic warfare. More at guardian.co.uk/world, where you can also read about the Taliban fighter with the Aston Villa tattoo. Could too much bacon kill you? Scientists say we should cut down on processed meats to avoid bowel cancer. Details at guardian.co.uk/health. Plus, get set for Wimbledon hype as Scotland's Andy Murray claims his first grass court victory at Queen's. That's at guardian.co.uk/sport. Next, Schools and Children's Secretary Ed Balls writes in The Guardian today that the Tories remain the party of cuts, while Labour will maintain its funding pledges despite the obvious pressure on government finances. Reporting from Westminster, The Guardian's Nick Watt says the focus is starting to shift from scandal to policy issues.
Well, we may possibly finally be putting the expenses row behind us that has been dominating British politics for well over a month now. The Daily Telegraph got that leaked CD of all those information of MPs' expenses, and all us other journalists have been busily having to follow it up every night. And it's interesting that last week, after Labour's really catastrophically bad performance in the local elections, we started to see potentially the beginnings of a new phase in politics, a pre-general election phase that could focus on the more traditional area of spending. And the reason why this blew up was that Andrew Lansley, who's the Shadow Health Secretary, appeared on the Today programme and said that the Conservatives, if they won the election, would have to cut public spending in all areas apart from health and international development by 10%. Labour pounced on this and said, ha ha ha, that's the Tories, we know what they do, they like to cut spending. To which the Tories said, no, we're talking about your figures. You are going to be having to cut spending after the next general election because it's going to be very tight. So we're now into one of those traditional rows. Gordon Brown would like the debate to be vote Labour and you'll get investment, vote Conservative and you'll get cuts. And David Cameron is saying vote Conservative, can't quite say what you're going to get, but you're going to get honesty. What's interesting about this is that Gordon Brown, when he raised this in the House of Commons last week, read out the spending envelope for how much money the government would be spending if they were elected in the post-2011 period. And indeed, it was like going up a stepladder. The amount of money does rise each year. But those are rises in cash terms, not real terms. And so the Tories are saying, be honest, we know you're going to have to cut.
The 10% that you mentioned, that is likely to be a campaign slogan, isn't it? 10% Cameron.
Well, Labour are now dubbing David Cameron Mr. 10%. Vote for David Cameron, your public services will be cut by 10%. Labour think that they've got the Tories on, from the Labour Party's perspective, some pretty strong territory, that the Tories are only saying they will make a guarantee in health, which is for real term increases. They will only make a guarantee in international development, which is to meet the UN target to spend 0.7% of GNI, gross national income, on aid by 2013. And everywhere else, schools, defence, Home Office, well, no guarantee there. So Labour think they've got the Tories in a strong position. The Tories say, we haven't spelt out our plans other than in health and in international development. We're just talking about your figures. So we're not the party that we were of 2001 in 2005, when they had some pretty specific tax commitments that were a gift to Gordon Brown, who just said, vote Conservative and your hospital and your school won't be safe.
And Ed Ball's writing in The Guardian today. He's pretty upbeat, isn't he? Although he is warning his colleagues to stop the infighting and turn on the Tories.
Well, it's interesting that Ed Ball's, and this is his first major intervention in his Guardian article today since the disastrous election results for Labour last week. Interesting intervention by Ed Ball's, very strongly coming in behind Gordon Brown, saying that yes, David Cameron does want to cut spending. Yes, public services wouldn't be safe under the Conservatives. But also an important message for the Labour Party. He opens his article by saying that it's a Labour Party divided and turning in on itself that will let the Tories off the hook. So that's a pretty important message there to obviously backbenchers in the Labour Party who were keen to bring Gordon Brown down. And indeed, some members of the cabinet who toyed with, thought of the idea of resigning, and then decided not to. And I wonder whether he possibly has David Miliband in mind, who gave an interview to us, The Guardian, on Saturday, in which he gave a pretty clear indication that he thought very seriously about resigning at the same time that James Purnell resigned, but decided in the end, no, he wouldn't resign, because he would take the fight to the Tories from the cabinet.
The Guardian's Nick Watt. After 8 months' preparation, the most comprehensive examination of media and telecommunication in the UK is due for release tomorrow. Headed by Gordon Brown's Communications Minister, Lord Carter, the Digital Review covers a wide remit, including modernisation of the industry, investment, providing access and skills development. It'll also spark conflict with, among others, the BBC over plans to take back some of the licence fee. Media commentator Steve Hewlett has been looking at the details.
There is an amount of money in the existing licence fee settlement earmarked for digital switchover, including things like the digital switchover help scheme, which is to help old people get boxes and convert. Now, in the first place, there's almost certain to be, it looks as if there's going to be an underspend in the amount of money allocated to that purpose. So between now and the end of the existing licence fee settlement, which is 2012-13, there's going to be an amount of money unspent by the BBC because it's not required for the help scheme. The Chancellor has already said that he intends to dip those funds to support broadband rollout, one of the big Digital Britain objectives. And also, it now looks likely that this new arrangement for local news provision on ITV may also be supported by the BBC in kind with its partnership proposals, but also possibly with cash. The bigger issue in the longer term is, if you roll this licence fee settlement forward, upraised by some index, there will be an amount in it, post-2012 this is, roughly equivalent to the £600 million that's in the existing settlement for digital switchover. Now, given that digital switchover will have finished in 2012, in theory, there's an amount of money, let's call it £600 million, which the BBC doesn't need for its core purposes. The big issue here is what Carter says about that amount of money, and there are advocates and people who are very keen to see a fund established using that money for supporting public broadcasting purposes beyond the BBC. That would count, I suppose, as top slicing proper, although strictly speaking it wouldn't come off the BBC's core provision because it's all money that's extra to it, but the constitutional implications of having a portion of the licence fee ring-fenced and ring-fenced for uses beyond the BBC and controlled by someone other than the BBC. Well, that's obviously quite serious.
I'm sure we could talk more on it. Let's talk about some other areas and what people want from this digital review. Local and regional newspapers, there's talk of asset swapping and mergers. What's going to happen there?
Well, there's been a bit of a perfect storm in local media. Take local TV. ITV has been the primary source of local TV, other than the BBC, for the last 50 years. ITV is desperate to depart the field as soon as it can, claiming that its licences don't no longer justify the expense it has to bear, you know, in return for those licences. And one of the key and one of the most expensive bits of their licence obligations left is regional news. So ITV is desperate to cut back. Ofcom sort of essentially accept ITV's arguments. So a new idea has come up, which is that local news might be provided by so-called independently financed news consortia. This would be local organisations made up of existing local TV operators, community groups, and possibly local newspapers and local radio stations, who would create programming, news programming, to put on Button 3. Now, on one hand, ITV's been retreating from the field. On the other, you know, it won't be news to you or any of your listeners to know that you know, the local press is in a state of virtual meltdown in many parts of the country. The advertising recession is sort of tearing the guts out of them. Strategically, they're hopelessly challenged by the attractiveness of the internet for classified advertising, which has been the source of so much support historically in commercial terms for local media. So local press is in a bit of a state of chassis. Local TV, such as it's been, is sort of MyTV desperate to withdraw from the field. So what we're going to see, I think, will be a commitment to address ownership rules and regulations so as to allow newspaper groups to get involved in supplying local TV.
There are plenty of other areas in this review, such as the gaming industry, who want a more favourable tax regime. But let's finish for now, because of time constraints, on piracy and how the creative industries are going to be protected under this review from internet pirates.
Well, so the question is, how far is the government going to go in terms of establishing a regime that will support the rights of content creators? Now, there are variations here. There are some people at one end who think it should be simply be a criminal offence, that people who do it should have their internet connections cancelled, and they're asking the internet service providers to police that. At the other end, there are people who say, well, it's just the way the world is. What you've really got are people trying to support what are essentially historically broken business models, and you might as well wake up and smell the coffee. And that to do that, i.e. to treat it as a criminal offence, would mean you know, rock bands, musicians, criminalising their fans. Now, they said this is quite complicated. How far the government will go along the lines being suggested by the big companies involved in intellectual property, music companies and the like, remains to be seen.
And there's full commentary and analysis on the review at guardian.co.uk/media. Finally, there'll be the inevitable comparisons to our next guest and Barack Obama. Alisa Stanton has achieved the distinction of being the first black woman in America to become a mainstream Jewish rabbi. The parallels are there. They're similar in age and both balanced racial and communal lines. The rabbi has been speaking to The Guardian's Ed Pilkington, who began by asking her whether she's faced any discrimination.
Growing up, I experienced racism as a Jew of color and walking into a synagogue. In the initial days, there were racism and comments and stares. And
this is in Denver.
And isolation, wherever I've been. Not just Denver. Denver was where I lived. But over the years, I'm glad to say we are evolving as a Jewish community. We have a ways to go, but right. We are evolving.
When you talk about the sort of comments and stares, can you tell me a little bit more detail? What kind of comments do people make to you?
No, I was in the Jewish community. It was the demographics of where I was mostly Anglo. I was different. I was other, so to speak. And there was not a place for me. However, there was a place. You know, I found home in my congregation that I later joined. My converting rabbi was wonderful. And there were wonderful moments and people along the way. But it was difficult. And I hear this throughout the country, actually throughout the world, and when I've traveled and talked to other Jews and Jews of color about them feeling displaced.
Do people make jokes at your expense? Often hurtful things come through jokes.
People have made jokes. They've made jokes. They've made disparaging remarks. They've made cutting remarks. But I choose to focus on the positive,
right,
and those individual and institutions who have helped to promote diversity and help me on the journey. I'm not going to focus on the ones who are negative.
Right. And on the, in terms of your African American community and biological family and community around you, that was also quite difficult at that time?
A lot of my African American friends thought I had sold out. And to this day, sometimes people don't understand. Oh yeah, you're a rabbi. So what church do you go to? Or you're a rabbi, but you know, and that's just not the African American community. It's kind of, people see it as an oxymoron, and so in some ways, but it's not. At the time in my circle that I was in, you know, you had blacks who were Christians, including Catholicism and Muslim. But there weren't any blacks who were Jews. And so it was, I think, startling for some people and unnerving for some.
Mm-hmm.
And even this weekend, and the ordination ceremony, there are protesters.
Really?
And who said some disparaging things about me, and my daughter came down to the where we were waiting to be ordained in tears, and one of my classmates talked to her, and we can't listen to them.
There was actually huge communality at one level between African Americans and Jews. And I'm thinking of, well, just the sheer fact that they both faced persecution and racism, I figure. So, you know, although people focused on a lot of the hostility, actually, you know, at a different level, there was a real affinity between the two communities.
There's been an affinity, and I can't speak for all. I won't be the spokesperson, or nor can I be, for all African Americans or for all Jews. I can only be the spokesperson for myself.
Precisely.
And I've had difficulties on both sides of the table. But I am both. They won't be mutually excluded. And I must say that the Jewish community, my inner circle, have been most supportive of this journey, financially, spiritually, and emotionally. And that people have sacrificed a lot to help get me where I am today. On both sides. I represent a face of the diversity within Judaism, right. Is more correct, because it's been there. It's just been...
Even now in America, because it's been obviously diverse around the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. There are a lot of Jews of different colors, different hues, and I think I bring that to the forefront now.
Ed Pilkington in Cincinnati speaking to America's first black female rabbi. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Producing today were Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.